Welcome to Middle Grade Mavens, where two author mums discuss their favourite middle grade books, provide recommendations, and share insider industry tips for authors trying their hand at middle grade. Julie Ann Grasso is the author of the Frankie DuPont mystery series, cupcake enthusiast and part-time library book wrangler. Pamela Ukerman is a writer, dancer, and homeschooling mum who sometimes finds time for sleep. Both Julie and Pamela devour middle grade books, not only for research, but to share with their combined brood of four munchkins.
Shirley Ma is a first-generation Chinese-Australian living in sunny Perth and an author of young adult and children's fiction, including Little Jiang, Pre-Loved, and Fury. Her latest book is A Glass House of Stars, and Shirley's here to talk to me about it today. Welcome to the podcast, Shirley. It's wonderful to have you on.
Hi, thanks for having me, Pam.
You're welcome. And so can you tell me where the idea for A Glass House of Stars came from?
Okay, so A Glass House of Stars is actually based on my real life experiences of migrating to Australia when I was a child at age 7. Mm-hmm. So it's real, but it's mixed in with a lot of magic as well at the same time.
Yeah, I love that. And so what made you decide to write about this experience?
It's like I've been trying to tell my life story because I think it's a very timely and important story at any stage of like human existence. So it's something I've been trying to sort of write for a very long time, but I just wasn't brave enough. It just felt too personal. And with the emergence of like own voices stories, I finally found the bravery in myself to write it. And once I did start writing my story, it just came out. And I just felt it's an important story to tell. And I think migration is one of those topics that we really do need to talk about.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I came out to Australia when I was 11 and I came out from England. So, you know, I came from an English-speaking country, you know, similar culture, but not the same. But a lot of the culture shock that Meijing experienced and that obviously you experienced was very familiar to me, because I experienced that too, just not from the language point of view. So, and we'll maybe get into that a little bit later, but I definitely agree that there's this, yeah, this migration story needs to be told and from, you know, own voices and from different perspectives. So, you know, Meijing in the story, she came over, she had this culture shock. Her parents struggled and then her father dies in a tragic accident. How much of that experience and the emotions around that were similar to yours when you came to Australia?
A lot of the experiences in the book actually happened to me. So there's a lot of truth in that story because I felt I had to inject a lot of my own personal experiences into it in order to make it authentic. Mm-hmm. So my family did suffer a lot of hardship when we came here. And being a young child of 7, not understanding the language, not being able to write it very well, and having to go to school along with these like very heavy Chinese traditional parental expectations, that was a big thing for me. And as a child, I just felt that weigh so heavily on me, especially like before we migrated, I was actually a very carefree, happy child. And I just found that once I came here, everything just changed. And it wasn't just like, oh, the food is different, the language is different. I just felt myself, I was changing and I was becoming different. And it was a sort of hardship that has been with me for the rest of my life. And it's something I really do want to talk about.
I'm absolutely nodding along here because, like I said, apart from the language side of things, which I can only imagine is, you know, just a huge extra burden, I was the same. I was, you know, I went from a carefree childhood in England where school was fun and I loved it and there was no teasing or bullying. I don't know, maybe I just got lucky where I was, but, you know, coming to Australia and then I just found that, you know, we had to live in a much poorer house to begin with while we sort of set up and, I was teased relentlessly. You know, school was very different. There's so many, many different things to adapt to that it's just, I think for an adult, it's hard to comprehend that. That's, you know, such a big change for a child. So it's great that you're writing about it and in such a relatable way.
Oh, thank you. And it's great that you're sharing your own story with me, Pam, because I think one of the best things about this book being out is, like, it started a lot of dialogue and conversations with people that would just come up to me and they would start telling me their stories about how they came to Australia, because after all, Australia is made up of a very large population of people who have come here. And so I've had people come up to me and tell me about how different the culture was when they first came here, and also people that migrated from places, like I have a friend who came from New Zealand, which you'd think would be very similar to Australia, but she found like her childhood just as traumatic because there was just so many things that she didn't understand that you think wouldn't matter, but to a child it does. Like she was given an assignment where she had to make a drawing out of texter, but she didn't know what a texter was. Like she called them felt tip pens. Yeah. So she tried to make a drawing with texture because that was the closest word that she could relate to the word texter.
Right.
And she just felt like so terrible when everybody had these like felt tip drawings and she had made something that was like three-dimensional and like tactile. And like, I can just imagine how her heart must have felt, like something like that for a child to experience. It's hard, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many other examples too. I can remember, you know, music, like I got here was put into grade six, and music was at the time was learning the words to In Excess songs, which most kids already knew, and I'd never heard of In Excess before, so I was, you know, left out. And yeah, there's just so many, every subject, every little area, there's just in it just weighs on you all day long, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the knock-on effect as well of like something small, and then it just sort of kind of like you carry it for a long time, even though the actual experience might not have lasted very long, but the impact of it, you kind of like you still remember, don't you? And the fact that you can remember meant that it was significant to you. And when you're a child, I think everything is significant, you know, so bad experiences do leave a lasting impression.
They do, absolutely. And I've actually written my story, not as a middle grade novel, but as a picture book as well. So, you know, that's like you, it's lasted this long and it still impacts me. So, yeah. So speaking about that, how did you handle writing such a difficult topic for you, and especially because Mei Jing's father dies fairly early on in the book in an accident? How did you handle writing that and making it palatable for your child reader?
I think that by putting in the element of magical realism, where there's like a mysterious glass house that she goes into and it sort of like shows her what she could become and what her future might be like, I think I tried to put in a lot of those elements so that the reader wouldn't feel like they're being suffocated by all these awful experiences, and that there was also a lot of hope to be gained, because I do believe in the power of resilience and in the power of believing in yourself, and a child being able to think that things will get better, and they do, but it might be hard while you're going through it to understand that. So I just wanted to have things like a little magical cat that could stand up by itself and serve you orange juice, and like a house that was scary but also nurturing at the same time and sort of like had a personality. So I put in a lot of like quirky and perhaps like, you know, mildly funny things as well, to sort of like lift the mood.
Yeah.
To me, what's more important than like examining trauma is examining hope.
Yes. You feel that through the book as well. There's, you know, you feel the emotions, and we'll talk about this soon, but being in second person, you really feel Mei Jing's feelings, but you also feel those, that the wonder and the hope and the imagination that she has. So because being in second person and your amazing attention to emotional detail, I was really drawn to also not just the character of Mei Jing, but also the character of Kevin, who's this little boy who's also migrated and gone through so much and has these very strict parents. And the way that he deals with that is through his negative behavior at school. Yet he's the one that Mei Jing relates to the most. And I just really, because I have two boys and they're not Kevin's, but, you know, I sort of just feel for naughty little boys, you know. And so did this characterization take a lot of honing, or did it come more from experience?
A blend of both. Because the three central characters in the book, Mei Jing, Kevin, and also another little boy called Josh, when the first classroom I was put in year one, like there were three migrants and the rest were like white Australians. So there was this little a Vietnamese child and also a Middle Eastern child. So I sort of based my two characters on these childhood friends I had. And I just wanted to draw out, take the topic of migration, and then also have two other journeys from two completely different perspectives, and just add that to the conversation as well.
I love that. It's interesting though, because when I moved to Australia, I was one of the very few Anglo people. There was only one Australian, white Australian in my class. Everyone else was, was migrants. it's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, very different case. And it was interesting. And I guess, you know, going back to that, this is all things that, you know, you experienced. It was interesting to read the relationships between the aunties who swooped in to help Mei Jing and her mother, and the misunderstandings that arise within the family. In a way, it's the aunties and the cousins that help Mei Jing find her voice, which to me was, you know, a lot of what the book was about. And was that always the case? Was that always the intention of sort of, you know, not just writing a migrant story, but writing this growth in Mei Jing?
That's right. Like the importance of your own community and your own family and your tribe being there to sort of ground and support you. I really wanted to show that as well. And, you know, convey that element of like, when you feel alone, you're not really alone when you have family around you. And like, sometimes you might not think that your mum or your dad or your, you know, cousins and aunties even care, but like they do, because they're your family and they love you.
Yeah. It was interesting. I interviewed Remy Lai recently, and she was saying in one of her books, it was sort of about that one of the relationships was kind of based on when she was a kid, she questioned whether her parents loved her, whether her dad loved her. And she, you know, she knows that he did, and she knew that even then that he did, but, you know, she wrote that into a story because she had felt that. So,
Yep, I definitely can relate, because with traditional Chinese parents, of course they love you. Like, they wouldn't like do the things they do, the way they raise you and bring you to a different country for a better life for you. They wouldn't do those things if they didn't love you. But unfortunately, it's not normally expressed through words or through sort of like gestures. Like, I come from a family that doesn't sort of hug or kiss, and we kind of really don't even stand like less than like a ruler apart. it's hard for a kid to understand, but as you grow, you do understand, and you do come to terms with that. Yeah. And that, I think that's important growth as well.
Yeah. And it is such a difference with Australian culture as well, because, you know, being English people aren't particularly physically affectionate either. in a different way from Chinese, but I completely get what you're saying. It's all expressed in a different way. which was, you know, not the case for the Italian and Maltese and Croatian friends that I had, or, you know, classmates that I had when I got over here.
Yeah, I think all cultures have their different ways of expressing, like, love. Like, with mine, it would be like my mum just, like, cooking and then making me eat and overloading me with food, and that's her way of saying, I love you, I want to nurture you. And it's only as an adult that I've finally understood that. Yeah, but that not everything is expressed in words. But it's really hard to kind of, like, read, like, a person's emotions when you're a kid, and you kind of just wish they would say I love you. But like, with culture, it's the way they grew up, the way they were raised, and the way that my grandparents were raised. It's just how it is.
Yeah, and I think you've put that through into the book, into Meijing's her thoughts and her, you know, the lessons that she's taken from that journey. I think you put that through in the book very well, so that, you know, the child reader can then get that. So I've been talking to different authors about the varieties of ways that magic can be brought into stories, the various conduits, shoes and candles and buttons in the last few. And as you mentioned before, in your book, it's the house and the cat and the glass house that are magical, and they represent the magic of imagination. Can you talk a little bit about how this came about and why you chose there to be these particular items were magical?
Okay, yeah, sure. Let's talk about the glass house first. When I'm writing, one of the important things for me is, like, the idea of reflection, so that a reader who is Chinese or Asian can pick up my book and see themselves in it. So in a way, the glass house is like this reflective object that I want to mirror out to them, and for them to see that, look, there's representation here, and it's a safe place. It's sort of like, it's filled with a garden. So it's a place of, like, where you can come for solace and for growth and for understanding, because, like, no matter who you are, what your life circumstance is, once you come into the glass house, you know, you instinctively know that everything's going to be okay. And that's the sort of, like, feeling I wanted to reflect. And as for the house, Big Scary herself, she came to me through, like, life experience. The funny thing is, I'm a migrant, but in a way I still feel like a migrant, because I haven't really settled down, because for the last 6 years I've actually changed houses like 5 times.
Wow.
It's an awful lot of moving. So I went from, like, a big house to an even bigger house, and then suddenly shrunk down to a small house. And now I've moved into, like, a big house again. And, like, while I was going through this house changing journey, I was pregnant for some of it, and I was also, like, nursing a small child and then raising a toddler throughout. And in my sort of, like, hazy mind, it didn't feel like I was actually moving house. It felt like I was in one spot, because my life was still the same, but that the house was sort of changing around me. So, like, it was like different rooms, and then sometimes I'd forget, oh, which house am I in now? Oh. And I would think one thing, walking that one way, and then be like, oh no, this is not the laundry, this is, like, the bedroom. So I thought to myself, you know, this would make a good character one day in one of my books, a house that sort of, like, you know, expands, contracts, depending on how it's feeling, and just random.
I love that.
And as for the cat, I love that movie, the Cat Returns, where we have lots of cats that stand on their hind feet, and I thought, you know what, I want a cat in my story. I think that's funny, and I'm a big cat lover, so I just thought, you know what, magical cats, I'm doing it.
Sassy magical cats, I like it. It's all a bit Alice in Wonderland meets The Secret Garden, I think.
I really like that description. I really like that pitch. Thank you.
Well, there you
That sounds
go.
really good. That's very flattering.
Well, The
Thanks,
Secret
Pam.
Garden was one of my absolute favorite books when I was growing up. So there you
Me
go.
too. I love it
And
too.
I totally relate to not knowing what house you're in, because I was pretty much similar when I when my kids were very little. We moved when my elder son was one. We moved back from Holland. He was born in Holland. We moved back to Australia, and then we're
Wow.
in three different houses in the first sort of 2 years. And then, since then we've been in the same house, but it was like four houses in two countries in 2 years. So I'd wake up and go, "Oh, where am I?"
It's that sort of feeling of sort of like, you're not knowing your surroundings and being a bit unsettled.
So now there's a part of this, an aspect of this book I really, really wanted to talk to you about. And that's that it's written in second person, which is almost never done. And the only time I've ever seen it is in sort of those choose your own adventure books. So,
Yep, I was going to say that.
yeah. So
That's the only
it's.
time I've ever seen it done too.
Well, there you go. So tell me then, how did that come? What was it like writing in second person? And how did the publisher respond to that?
It was nothing I'd done before, and it wasn't intentional at the beginning because I started writing in first person, like describing myself using, the terms I and me. But I just found I couldn't do it when I started writing like that because the story just felt too close and too raw to myself, and I just thought I need to distance myself from it. Otherwise, I'm just going to be like crying and it'd be like writing a painful journal or a diary instead of a story. So then I switched to third person. So I tried to write sort of looking in. But that didn't work either because I just felt too disconnected when I wrote in the third person. Like I was describing something that felt too far away, too disconnected. And it was only by chance, because I didn't expect this story to work, because after having those two attempts and nothing working, I thought maybe it's not a story that's going to be told. And that can happen sometimes. And I'm like, sometimes you've got to let stuff go. But while I was on holiday, I chanced upon a secondhand store because I was looking for something to read because I was bored. Bored of just, sitting around looking at beaches. What a life. So I walked into like a secondhand bookstore and I picked up Dead Girls by Nancy Lee, and it's a book of short stories. And the first story is actually written in second person. And I had never seen this done before, apart from like in Choose Your Own Adventure. And like the fact that it was actually quite beautiful to read, I was very surprised. Because when you think second person, you think the story goes, you are stuck in a cave.
Yeah,
You can go
exactly.
left or you can go right.
That's right, exactly.
It's 50 if you choose to go right. Like that sort of language. I didn't know it could be beautiful. So that was a revelation to me. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to give it a go. I'm very inspired. So, and as soon as I started writing in that second voice, the story just, it just seemed to come to me like so easy, like after struggling with it for so long, like my entire life trying to write it. And the basic bones of it was done within 3 months. So, yeah, very surprising even for myself. So I was like, I might have something here. But then again, there was this doubting voice at the back of my head going, who's going to read this? Like an entire novel in second person? That's ridiculous. But I kind of believed in it. I'd written the whole thing. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to send it out there to agents and publishers and see what comes back.
What was the response to that? Did you
I
get
was very.
people, did you get people saying, "Oh, you just can't do that, it doesn't work," or?
I did get some. It was really, really polarizing. I would get feedback from publishers and agents saying, oh, no, this is too different, not what we're looking for. But then I'd get really passionate people that went, I want to see the rest of this, because most of the time you're submitting like, you know, one page or like three chapters.
Yeah.
And it wasn't long before an agent, a super agent, maker of stars called Gemma Cooper, sent me an email saying, I want to see the rest of this. Please send it to me.
Wow. Yeah, she is a superstar too.
She is a superstar.
Yeah.
And before I knew it, she was like, I love this. I want to sign you on. And I was like, what? Because I've been trying to get an agent for a very long time. It's been like 117 rejections over 5 projects for me.
Yeah.
And like, I put this one in with like not hoping for much because it was so different. So I was like in shock. I was like, what? Wow. Are you serious?
That's the thing though. I mean, it's, you know, something different can be good and can be bad. But, you know, when I first read the first page, I say this in review, I was like, oh, it's in second person, you know. And then I kept going. And because it was recommended to me by Jessica Townsend, I was like, well, it's probably, you know, it must be pretty good. And then I've just fell in love with it. You know, and that second voice just kind of it disappears into the background. Like, you don't notice it anymore, but it is something different at the same time. So I'm not surprised that Gemma was excited. And that's amazing, because, you know, she's up there on top of, you know, agents we would like to be with.
Yep, definitely. But I guess it's a lesson in believing in yourself and believing in your voice. And daring to do something like complete a manuscript, even though you've got that niggling voice at the back going, yeah, you know, it's not going to work out. You're probably just wasting your time. I think if you can just not trust your voice and just trust the process and go for it, there's something to be said there.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well done you. It's amazing. I love it. Yeah. And, you know, you're told when you start writing courses, you know, we write in first person or third person, never second person, unless you're writing a choose your own adventure. And I'm glad that you just...
Exactly.
Yeah, you didn't listen to that.
I know what it's like, because I have a writing group and I said to them, guess what, girls? I've written something in the second voice, and they were all horrified. They said, why would you do that? And then I showed them the first page and I said, what do you think? And they were all ready to like tear it apart. Look, I'm not like sort of like, you know, speaking bad of them, because they're my wonderful supportive friends.
Yeah.
But then they read it and went, you know what, I think it works.
Yeah. Well, you made it work. So there you go.
So we're all surprised, including myself.
I love that.
And I'm still surprised when people react positively to it, because I was expecting it to be like a Marmite thing. I'm still in my head thinking, oh, you know what, it's going to be one of those small books that maybe like a small group of people kind of like, and the rest go, yeah, it's one of those like weird arty farty books that, you know, no one's going to read that.
Well, you know, it helps that it has a beautiful cover as well. I think the cover is absolutely gorgeous, and I think that's, you know, half the battle in getting someone to even start a book is the cover. And once you get past that and the first page, then, you know, you're in.
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it? The cover by Cornelia Lee.
Yeah.
Chinese Canadian artist, amazing. And her work has been on a lot of covers of like major publications, and her style is just so beautiful. And like, I think as authors, we always have that dread factor when it comes to seeing the cover for the first time, because you have no idea like how an artist is going to interpret like your story. But as soon as I saw the cover, I was like, oh my goodness, it's beautiful. And she completely gets it, and it was like, it is like what I thought in my head it would look like.
Wow, so I
just cried. I was so happy.
I bet. It's gorgeous. And so I mentioned to you, we were just talking about Jessica Townsend. I mentioned to you earlier that she told me about this book way back last year. And I know there's an interesting story there about with you and Jessica. So do you want to tell us about that?
Yes. Jessica is my unofficial discoverer. Like, she scouted me. She's my talent scout. And I feel really bad that she's going around telling everyone about this book that she's discovered. Like she's like my Simon Cowell. She discovered me. Because I'm not even paying her. I probably owe her like a lot of coffees. But as the story goes, Jessica Townsend and Gemma, who we mentioned before, Gemma Cooper, they were both on a train bound for Paris. I believe they were both going to a book fair. And to pass the time, what Gemma had done was print out all these manuscripts from her slush pile, so all the unsolicited manuscripts. Uh-huh. And they were just going through them. Jessica pulled out one. It happened to be my manuscript.
Ah.
And she started reading it. And then she turned to Gemma and said, look, you've got to sign this one. And Gemma went, yeah, let me have a look. So she had a look and went, oh, this one's pretty good. And so because I was eventually signed for that manuscript, Glass House of Stars in its infancy, Jessica was the first person to read it outside of me and my critique group and my family and friends.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Oh, what an amazing story. What a very international beginning.
Yeah, I know. I think there might be a movie in it, you know, where
Jessica
comes and discovers me. You know, when they make her, like, biography in a movie.
Yeah.
There'll be that scene where she discovers me. Yeah. And hopefully I can cameo as myself.
All about how she wrote how many books. Everything she's ever written into the work. Jessica has an amazing story herself. So all the work that goes into the Nevermore books. But yeah, she brought yours out to life. I love that. So now the only thing I need to do is to meet Gemma Cooper. I'm going to have to get one of you to sign me up with her because I have sent her stuff before.
Oh yeah, I'll put in a word for you.
Oh, thank you.
I'll just say, you gotta watch out for this.
It's the Australians really taking over the British agents.
Yeah, and it's surprising. The American and the British agents, they love Australians.
They do, yeah, they do.
I think we breed like a different flavour.
Yeah. And it's all different. In English, so it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I know that you have a career behind you as an accountant. And are you still working full time and writing, or you know, how do you juggle that?
I'm still working in my boring accounting day job. I am. Wow. I call it boring, but I secretly love it. I do like working with like numbers and figures, and like I'm thinking to myself, I'm so practical. Look at my practical job. And in a way, like because, you know, my parents brought me to Australia and they wanted me to have like, you know, a good, stable, well-earning job. Like I feel like by still doing this job, I'm kind of like honouring what they want, while secretly at night I can do what I want, which is to do the writing. So it's, for me, it's like a balance, because I am in a way still stuck between two worlds, the East and the West. So that's how I structure my life.
Yeah, which is interesting, you know, even though you've got all that behind you, you've got kids, you've got all that success, and you still do feel that pull between the two sides of you.
I do. I still feel like, because I was raised in Australia for virtually all my life, so I consider myself quite Australian. But at the same time, I can't escape from that pull of my parents' culture and where I came from. And as I get older, I feel like it's really important for me to honour that part of myself, because it is part of myself. And it was my mum's wish that I went to uni and did like a sensible business degree, which I did. And I think she's proud that I achieved that dream of making something of myself coming to Australia. But recently, to my surprise, because I never thought that she would be supportive of my writing, because that's sort of like what Shirley likes to do in her spare time, which is fine. I think she's secretly proud of my writing as well. Well, they should never say it.
Yeah,
I think she is. I think she was very proud when she went to her local Big W and there was like my books there. So my mum actually brought all six of them.
Oh, there you go. That's her telling you that she's proud, right? That's her way of telling you. Yeah.
And I think that's probably the highlight of my, 20 years plus of writing and thinking, my parents will never approve of this, because they never wanted me to do this writing. I kind of floated doing like an English degree at one point in my life and it was like, oh, no, not an arts degree. You can't make a living out of that. So I always thought my parents like were never proud of my writing. But you know what? I think they are. It's just that same like misinterpretation I was telling you about, where just because they don't say it in words doesn't mean that they don't love you for something or they're not proud of you for something.
Yeah. And that, you're saying that you were seven when you came over here, so it was only 7 years in China, but the rest of your life, at least until you were an adult, your upbringing was Chinese because your parents were still Chinese and that's how they brought you up. So it's, it's not just a small part of your life, that culture, it's a large part of your life and it's still there because, you've still got to have that interpretation sort of conversation with your mum. So yeah. And it's similar. I mean, we went back to stay with my parents a couple of weeks ago because we're renovating. I took my kids to my parents and it reminded me of, when I was a teenager still at home with my parents who are still very English and they still are English, and I've realized that I do things differently now because I've adapted and, got married and found out other ways to do things, but that English culture still is there. So, you can't really get rid of it.
No, you can't run away from yourself or your roots, but I'm in my head, I'm thinking your English parents are very, in my head anyway, very quaint and they have cups of tea and like, proper teapots?
Not proper teapots, but yeah, I at home I normally only have about two cups of tea a day. So I still drink tea, as an English person. But when I went back, when I was staying with my parents, I was having four or five cups a day because,
oh yeah, lovely.
That's what they do.
Yeah.
Tea's a, very big part of English culture. So what is the one thing that you hope readers will take from The Glass House of Stars?
Most importantly, I hope that they will think about migration on a personal level, like how it affects a person coming to Australia or any other country, and not in terms of like a faceless mass of people, which you often see like on the media, like in a negative light. Yep. So if they read my book and they feel empathy and a sense of wishing to understand better, then I think I've done my job and I'll be proud of that.
Yes. Anyone who reads your book will definitely get that. Amazing. So The Glass House of Stars is available now in all good bookstores. Where can our listeners find you online if they want to find out more?
They can find me on shirleymar.net. That's my website. And from there, you can find me on Insta and follow me and I'll follow you back and we'll do some fun stuff.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Shirley. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, Pam, for having me.
Thanks for stopping by Middle Grade Mavens. If you'd like to know more about the Mavens, log on to middlegradepodcast.com or to find Julie online, stop by julieandgrassobooks.com and to find Pamela, stop by www.uckerman.net.